order for the time being, and I expect each of you to do just that. Even so, Admiral Qian said, the container ship... The Paramount leader raised his hand once more, this time signaling it was time to move on. The Admiral, unaccustomed to taking such orders, seemed to swell even more than usual with unspoken words. Had Huang been less of a professional, he would have laughed out loud. I assure you, Joe said, if the Americans had anything to do with sinking the Orion, I will take decisive action. The white phone on Joe's desk buzzed, but he did not answer it, apparently expecting the signal. He stood, grimacing a little at the effort. The others in the room rose with him, which is what one did for the most powerful man in China, even if they did not agree with him. Gentlemen, Joe said, you must excuse me. The men began to file out the door next to Huang, but the chairman spoke again. Foreign Minister Li, he said. Li paused at the threshold, close enough that Huang got a noseful of his strong cologne. Would you be so kind as to remain a moment? Li Zhengsheng turned and gave a slight bow toward the man who had appointed him. Of course, General Secretary. Joe motioned to a chair and then turned toward a door that led to his private restroom, to the right of his desk. Please excuse me for a moment, he said. This meeting was agonizingly long. Huang took a step away from the wall, but Joe waved him off. You may go now, Colonel, Joe said. Huang paused, waiting, as if hoping Joe might change his mind. The Paramount leader gave a forced smile, obviously in severe discomfort. I will be fine, Huang, he said. Minister Li is like a brother to me. Very well, sir, Colonel Huang said. I will remain outside the door. Please call if you need me. Colonel Huang closed the office door behind him, certain that he'd just left the man whom he was charged with protecting in the room with an extremely deadly snake. The General Secretary finished in his private restroom 2 agonizing minutes later. When he returned to his office, he found a small, skeletal man seated beside the foreign minister in front of his desk. The new arrival's thinning gray hair revealed a strong crop of liver spots on a high forehead. He wore a white lab coat and black tie. His shirt pocket was stuffed with an array of expensive fountain pens, the way a military man might wear his medals. Dr. Ho. Joe regarded the man with a curt nod. Both Ho and Foreign Minister Li stood and remained standing until Joe was seated. Zhou Juxi, the doctor said in a voice much too deep for his small stature, your secretary showed me in. I hope you do not mind. Not at all, Joe said. I trust that you read my notes, and now you have some good news for me. Dr. Ho was one of 3 staff doctors serving within the walls of the Zhongnan Hai. He was old enough to be Joe's father, possibly even his grandfather, and dispensed advice with great pomposity, as if he were Confucius himself. The other 2 doctors were attending some medical training in Nanjing until the following day. Joe found himself in dire straits, or he never would have summoned this man. The doctor lifted his nose toward the ceiling and fluttered his eyelashes as if he were explaining something very simple to a small child. I read your description of the ailment. General fatigue, pain, and difficulty in passing water. Slight fever. Tell me, does it feel as if you are sitting on a stone? Joe nodded. You might say that, he said. The doctor took a bottle of pills from the pocket of his lab coat and pushed them across the desk. No doubt the General Secretary is suffering from an acutely aggravated prostate. I would prescribe 2 of these capsules 3 times a day. The pills are quite large, so be certain to take them with plenty of fluids. I also suggest a marked increase in the frequency of physical congress between the General Secretary and Madam Zhou. Joe took the pill bottle and rolled it around in his palm. Swallowing a large pill will be an easy task when compared to the remainder of your prescription. The notion of explaining to his wife that the doctor ordered them to have more sex would have been comical had he not been in so much pain. What is in the capsules? Antibiotics. The doctor shook his head. Yin Yang Hu, he said. Horny goatweed, the foreign minister repeated. And saw palmetto, the doctor added. A very effective remedy when combined with the increased... Thank you, doctor, Joe said. Foreign Minister Li looked away, as if biting his tongue. All three men were silent for a long moment, and then the doctor said, Was there anything else, General Secretary? Joe shook his head. No, he said. That will be all. I appreciate your diagnosis. The doctor shut the door as he left. I am all for Eastern medicine, Comrade Joe, the foreign minister said, offering a friendly smile. But I will see to it that my doctor prescribes you some antibiotics. I would appreciate that, Joe said. This is a perfect example of how we must move forward. Herbs have their place, but there are times when one needs actual medicine. If I may be so bold as to ask a question, Li said. Of course, Joe said, swallowing two capsules of horny goatweed to hedge his bets. Do you think there is any chance the Americans are behind the sinking of the Orion? Joe sighed. It is possible. But to what end? True, Li said. Truthfully, though, I would not put anything past Jack Ryan. He is, I believe, a man with much guile. I do not think it is guile, Joe said. It is determination. And that is sometimes more dangerous. Again, you are right, Li said. There is something else on your mind, my friend. You are an astute observer, Joe Jushi, Li said. Tell me. I hesitate to bring it up. But I am concerned about your push against the wealthy of the party. Joe waved that off. I am not interested in wealth. You yourself are one of the wealthiest men I know. I am prosecuting corruption. You know best, of course. I will see to your antibiotics. I hope your health improves quickly. He gave a sly wink. In the meantime... I must remind my wife of her conjugal responsibility to my health. Joe gave a polite chuckle, letting the body comment slide. He preferred to keep things on a loftier level when dealing with members of his cabinet. I understand you are hosting a dinner party tomorrow. Li shook his head and shrugged. Nothing special. General Ma will attend, as well as General Xu and a few other minor guests. Such periodic functions allow me to keep a finger on the pulse of Beijing. General Xu of the Central Security Bureau. The foreign minister nodded. Yes. Be wary of that one, Joe said. He gives me cause for concern. How so? Joe narrowed his eyes, studying the man across his desk. He has... How shall I put this? A bad smell. I intend to make changes in that organization in the near future. The Central Security Bureau is, after all, tasked with your protection. I don't want to see it turned into a personality cult. You should be watchful. I appreciate your concern, Joe Jushi, and I will be careful. See that you do, my friend, Joe said. I am very rarely wrong about my sense for a person's character. The foreign minister gave him a passive smile. That is interesting to note, Mr. Chairman. General Ma Xianyan exited the great hall that housed the General Secretary's office and turned left to make his way along one of the many wide pathways inside the high walls of the Zhongnan High. His office was on the far side of the lake known as the Middle Sea, and he had to walk across a bridge to reach it. His status was such that he could have taken a cart, but the weather was dry and warm, and in any case, the walk allowed him to burn off some of his contempt for the young upstart who was now in charge of the party. Deng Wenyuan, secretary of the Central Committee for Discipline Inspection, met the general before he reached the bridge. It was a well-known fact in the intelligence world that people stopped to chat on bridges, making them perfect spots in which to hide listening devices. People who wanted to speak openly avoided them, as well as any of the many benches that graced the park-like setting. Secretary Deng was impeccably dressed in a dark business suit, tailored especially for him in London on a recent junket. The CCDI oversaw the propaganda and organization department, and as such had the power to sway and even direct public opinion. The two men exchanged greetings, bowing slightly to each other. They kept their tone civil and their faces passive. Because they were senior members of the party, there was no doubt that passers-by would pay them close attention, even while pretending not to do so. "And?" Secretary Deng asked. "It went as you might expect," Ma said, keeping his words vague. He was thinking, pitiful, disastrous, unconscionable. But he said, "Disappointing." "Something must be done," Deng said. "And it is," Ma said, "even as we speak." "Something drastic?" General Ma smiled. "Something final." Chapter 10 Jack Ryan Jr. parked the maroon Dodge Avenger across a side street from a weathered brick building in a sad parking lot tucked in off Harry Hines Boulevard. He and Chavez had purchased the car with cash from a dealership in East Dallas, on the off chance that someone had seen the Rattlecan Taurus. Ryan now wore a shaggy wig with bleached blonde surfer tips pulled snugly over his dark hair, just covering his ears. It was an expensive piece of equipment that looked ridiculously real and, he hoped, made him look a little less like the son of the President of the United States. A large sign above the windowless building bore the red neon outline of a busty woman bending over and peeking around her own thigh. Ryan nodded toward the sign and mused. "Chicas peligrosas," he read. Ding Chavez translated from the passenger seat of the Dodge. "Dangerous girls." Ryan rolled his eyes. "Even I could figure that one out." Chavez held the 2-foot Yagi directional Wi-Fi antenna out his open window toward the front door of the Dangerous Girls strip club. The simple device resembled a miniature ladder made of a single aluminum bar with short aluminum cross-sections running along its length. Chavez fiddled for a few moments with the connected laptop, scrolling through a string of 12-digit Bluetooth addresses, searching for Eddie Fung's phone. "Artengo's in there, all right," he said over the net, and then shot a glance at Ryan. "Don't beat yourself up because you're not multilingual, Mano. You're a damned savant when it comes to analysis." "Thanks for that," Ryan said, "but I've decided I'm going to start working on my Russian." Chavez shut his computer and set it and the Yagi antenna on the floorboard at his feet. He opened the door and grinned. "We all got our individual strengths. You can't help it if yours is staring at spreadsheets." Ryan laughed as he followed Chavez toward the double front doors of Chicas Peligrosas. "You know I'm joking, right?" Chavez said. Ryan patted Chavez on the back. "I learned a long time ago, if you're not giving me shit, then something is terribly wrong." "Jack knows you love him," Clark said over the net. "How about you guys go get us some intel on Eddie Fung?" "Copy that," Chavez said. Gavin Beery had a GPS proximity notification on Eddie Fung's phone, allowing the team to grab a few hours of much-needed sleep after he stopped moving for the night. But Fung was apparently a man on a mission. He was up and at him again just after noon. Now Midas Jankowski and Dom Caruso were in the truck a half a block away. Adara Sherman was going it alone today, another block down Harry Hines Boulevard to the south. The daylight hour made climbing onto a rooftop problematic, so John Clark sat behind the wheel of a primer gray Pontiac Firebird around the corner in the parking lot of a Pep Boys auto supply store. He did not have physical eyes on like he'd had the night before, but each team member's location was transmitted via a small GPS tracker to his iPad, giving him a common operating picture of everyone involved, as a color-coded icon representing each one moved around a digital map of the vicinity. Successful surveillance operations took several teams to do them correctly and safely, especially if the subject decided to run SDRs, surveillance detection routes, which Eddie Fung did not. In fact, he'd committed the OPSEC fail from hell by never looking behind him and seemed completely blind to the possibility that someone might want to follow him. Ryan couldn't figure out if the man was stupid or merely bad at tradecraft. Clark decided Ryan and Chavez would go into Chicas Peligrosas to get an eyeball on Fung, note the lay of the land inside. They would rotate out with Midas and Dom if Fung stayed too long. Midas's years working with the unit in Central and South America had made him conversant in Spanish. Dom spoke Italian, which allowed him to grab the gist of Spanish conversations going on around him. Adara spoke passable Spanish as well, but while females were not unheard of as patrons of strip clubs, her blonde hair and athletic build were sure to draw unwanted attention from the very people they were there to watch. As team leader, Clark took his job of oversight seriously, even with a goofball like Eddie Fung. "Everyone stay alert," he said. "Don't let the daylight lull you."
"Roger that, Mr. C," Ding said to his father-in-law.
"Here we go," Ryan mumbled as they approached the door. "You're too young to be tired of looking at naked girls," Chavez said.
"Not naked girls per se," Ryan said. "Just the kind that hang out in places like this."
"I hear you there, Mono," Chavez said.
The odor of an old carpet stewed in cheap booze and stale cigarettes hit Ryan in the face as soon as he opened the door.
"Well, this sucks," he said under his breath as soon as he stepped across the threshold.
He'd fully expected to see a handful of triad or cartel types, but was startled to find one of the largest Hispanic men he'd ever seen sitting beside a magnetometer, presumably to check IDs. Pushing 7 feet tall, the big guy had to weigh in at a good 350 pounds. Much of his bulk was fat, but Jack had learned from experience that heavy guys built up a considerable amount of muscle just hauling their own weight around. This one eclipsed the small stool he was sitting on, completely blocking the entry. A tattoo of what looked like a female version of death stuck up from the collar of his t-shirt. He hadn't shaved or showered in a long time, and Ryan was surprised they hadn't gotten wind of him outside. He half expected fee-fi-fo-fum to be the first words out of the guy's mouth. Instead, the big man grunted and asked, "Armas?" giving Ryan, and then Chavez, the evil eye once over. "Guns?" Ryan hunched his shoulders, slouching some to look less threatening than his 6-foot-1 frame would normally indicate. There was a time to be intimidating, and this was not it. Bouncers paid a hell of a lot more attention to tough guys than they did to nervous pushovers with bleached tips. Both men were indeed strapped, each carrying a Smith & Wesson M&P Shield 9mm. The small single-stack pistols were virtually invisible under the men's shirts, but even so, guns could be explained away. Dopers carried guns. Hell, half the people in Texas did. The wire neck loop mics and the rest of the comms package, however, would likely earn them each a hole in the head. Jack assumed the dozen Asian and Hispanic men in the place were armed, but management evidently wanted to double-check any new faces. Chavez started to say something in Spanish, but Jack noticed just in time that the cord at the base of the magnetometer was unplugged from the wall. He gave his partner a quick elbow in the ribs. "No, Armas," Ryan said, eyes on the dancers as if he was enthralled, trying his best for a lecherous college boy look. "We're all about the girls, not the guns." He peeled a couple $20 bills off a roll from his pocket and gave the big guy an embarrassed grin.
"To tell you the truth, this is my first time in a titty bar. Do we pay the cover charge to you, or what?"
The twenties looked like Monopoly money in the big guy's massive hands as he snatched them away.
He lifted his chin and grunted toward a trio of skinny Asian girls swaying on the stage.
They'll dance better if you give them a little cash. But hands off the merchandise unless you work out an extra arrangement with me or Manolo, the bald guy in the white shirt at the end of the stage.
Got it. Ryan gave a compliant nod and gulped for effect, his eyes wide and seemingly transfixed on the poor gyrating women. A dozen low tables ran in front of the stage, some occupied by small groups of Hispanic or Asian men. Triad or cartel according to their significant ink, each stuck with his own ethnicity. Two rosy-cheeked white guys in City of Dallas municipal worker coveralls occupied the nearest table. Ryan counted 16 patrons in all, counting Manolo and the Asian man with the ridiculous faux hawk sitting at the table beside him. That one had to be Eddie Fung. The North Texas Crimes Against Children Task Force was housed in a nondescript hangar leased by the Federal Bureau of Investigation on the northeast side of Dallas Love Field Airport. The three agents that made up the ICAC, or the Internet portion of the Crimes Against Children Task Force, worked at a bank of computers in a windowless area with their backs to the far wall. These two women and one burly man, all parents themselves, spent much of their workday posing as children, engaged in online conversation with some of the sickest minds on the planet. It was a target-rich environment, with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children estimating 75,000 would-be traders in child pornography online at any given time. The ICAC workstations were purposely situated with their backs to the walls, giving them some semblance of security and allowing them to look up and view a glimpse of the semi-normal life of their brothers and sisters in arms in the bullpen just a few yards away. The CAC Task Force Commander, FBI Special Agent Kelsey Callahan, didn't believe in separate offices. If her team was going to wade through the river of shit that the perverts they hunted caused, they should do it together as a unified group. She did, however, put her desk at the head of the open bullpen, so she'd have direct access to the whiteboard behind her. No straight-laced Betty Bureau blue suit. Special Agent Callahan wore a Neiman Marcus silk blouse in subtle pink and stone-washed jeans over hips that she wished were a smidge smaller, but that were still small enough so as to make the .40 caliber Glock 23 in the holster on her belt look huge. Her instructors at Quantico had called her curly copper ponytail a murder handle. She considered chopping it off for the academy, but she'd had long hair since high school. And besides, she needed to cling to every last vestige of femininity in this overly masculine profession. Callahan resolved early on to unleash 9 kinds of hell on anyone who got close enough to even touch her hair, and went on to prove that resolve to an exuberant defensive tactics instructor who thought he'd teach her the error of her thinking and grabbed her from behind. She dislocated her own shoulder, but ruptured the instructor's testicle. Her injuries saw her recycled into the next class of Nats, new agent trainees, but the badass reputation that followed her into her career was worth repeating 3 weeks of training. The reputation of being what Texas Department of Public Safety Sergeant Derek Burke called a half a bubble off plum only added to her success leading the North Texas CAC Task Force. Sergeant Burke's desk was to the immediate right of Callahan's, facing the bullpen, but the 40-year-old trooper and father of three now stood beside her, looking over her shoulder at the files on the screen of the standalone laptop at her desk. It was Sergeant Burke who had brought her the USB drive, retrieved the night before by a trooper posted to Mansfield. Department of Public Safety computer gurus had run all manner of diagnostics to check the drive for viruses. FBI techs had double and triple checked it for remote access Trojans, ransomware, and other viruses. Even after the device had been pronounced free from malware, FBI higher-ups still directed it only be inserted into a computer with the modem disabled and not attached to any network. Burke leaned in, his hand on Callahan's desk. "Looks like some kind of spreadsheet," he said. "Accounting records, maybe? And encrypted notes." The FBI agent scrolled upward, nodding. Not encrypted, she said. Coded. We can open them. We just can't tell what they mean. I see the word coronet a lot. Mean anything to you?
Nope.
Callahan mused as she scrolled, as much to herself as to Burke. I'm not finding anything to give us the location of this Eddie Fung bastard. After what Blanca Limon told me about him, I really, really want to find this guy.
She leaned back in her chair and looked up at the sergeant.
I'll let the organized crime squads figure out the rest of the trash on this thumb drive. What I do need is to have a little chat with the guy who pays for sex with a little girl as young as Blanca. According to her, there's another girl, a friend of hers named...
Callahan looked at the printed FBI 302 beside her laptop. Magdalena Rojas.
The guy your trooper killed dropped Magdalena at some creepy mansion in the country. She is at this very moment being made to do God knows what. If we find this Eddie Fung and squeeze him a little, maybe, just maybe, we can find her.
Callahan took a breath, as if she was coming up for air.
Burke, who was used to her passion, stood by and listened. Callahan glanced back down at the 302. Your trooper made the traffic stop south of Mansfield. Blanca says a pimp named Parrot took her and Magdalena to work a party with a bunch of other girls south of Dallas last night. Eddie Fung was there. He gives us the address of that party, and we'll have a search line between there and the Mansfield traffic stop.
That's still a lot of open ground, Burke said.
Callahan scrolled through the columns of numbers, looking for anything that might give her an address. It's all we've got right now. Maybe we'll get lucky and Fung will know where the mansion is, the sick bastard. Two desks away, FBI Special Agent John Olson pitched his cell phone onto a stack of paperwork and slumped in his chair, rubbing his eyes. Callahan looked up at him.
I sincerely hope you're about to tell me Fort Worth PD has Parrot Villanueva in custody.
Olson shook his head. I wish. His apartment's empty and he's in the wind. We have an APB out for him, but unless he gets jammed up over a broken taillight or something.
Callahan stood and used the flat of her hand to pound on her Vietnam War-era metal desk. The noise echoed off the high ceiling of the spacious hangar. She did this at least twice a week, and everyone on her team knew what it meant. A new turd had floated to the surface of their little world, and he was now their priority. Six police officers from four different municipalities and two sheriff's departments, three Texas Department of Public Safety investigators, three special agents from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and three from the FBI Dallas field office all peered around their computers, ready to receive marching orders. Some were relatively new. Others had been on the task force for a couple years. But all the CAC task force members had so much experience rescuing kids that they'd accumulated a deep and abiding hatred for the men and women they hunted. It was controlled hatred, hatred that Callahan made sure they kept within the bounds of the law, but it was hatred nonetheless. Callahan banging on her desk was like the horn to a foxhound. Every member of the team sat poised, twitching to channel their hatred into the hunt.
Okay, listen up. There's a 13-year-old girl out there named Magdalena Rojas who needs our help. Right now, our best chance at finding her is a worthless little creeper named Eddie Fung.
She threw the last name like an expletive.
Not sure if it's Edward or Eddie. He speaks English, but judging from the scant information we have, he may be Chinese.
Joe Rice, a detective working off a federal grant from the Waxahachie Police Department, raised his pen. He was in his 50s. With thinning blonde hair and a drooping mustache, he'd probably not shaved since his first days in the police academy 30 years before. A new grandfather and a deacon in the Waxahachie First Baptist Church, he was the reason Callahan didn't curse as much as she would have liked to.
Do we got a photo of Eddie Fung?
We will as soon as you get me one, Joe, Callahan said. She'd conducted the interview with Blanca Limon, so she had a general physical description.
Our only witness is another 13-year-old girl named Blanca, who was being forced to turn tricks with Magdalena. Blanca describes Fung as being in his mid-30s, around 5'8", slender build with glasses. She says he downs energy drinks like they're going out of style. and he's sporting a faux hawk. Of course he is, Olsen said, still rubbing his eyes.
I've got him on Facebook, an African-American detective named Jermaine Armstrong said. The Dallas PD detective was a dedicated gym rat and wore the sleeves of his gunmetal t-shirt rolled up over biceps the size of cantaloupes. He also possessed the uncanny ability to sell anything to anyone, especially online. He turned his laptop around to show Eddie Fung's profile pic, complete with a can of Red Bull and the faux hawk. Once Callahan had seen it, Armstrong turned the computer back and began to peck at the keys again. Callahan hit an icon on her desktop and pulled up an image of the detective's screen on the whiteboard behind her. Armstrong peered over the top of his computer.
Our little friend Sugar just sent him a friend request. According to Messenger, he's online right now. He should be getting back to her shortly if he likes what he sees.
Sugar was the name of a computer-generated image of a 12-year-old girl who could have been a Hispanic or Filipina. The avatar allowed law enforcement to pose and talk to men under her identity without using the image of an actual human child. Sugar was dressed innocently enough in a pair of pink shorts and simple white t-shirt. Sadly, that innocence was the hook for a great many men.
Eddie Fung accepted Sugar's friend request almost instantly, which was not surprising, since he'd chosen to pay for the services of little Blanca Limon. Detective Armstrong, burly man that he was a genius at writing under the guise of a preteen girl.
Bored, he typed. What are you up to?
Fung's words marched across the screen.
Do I know you?
Megan says you are cool.
I guess Megan knows, Fung said. Where's she at now?
Armstrong typed, Texas, stupid. He finished it with a squinty emoticon with its tongue sticking out.
Fung came back almost instantly.
Are you in Texas, too?
Armstrong slash Sugar sent a blue thumbs up.
Cool, Fung said.
Armstrong cast the net.
Want to trade picks? See if you like what you see? I'm bored shitless.
You shouldn't curse, Fung said.
Sorry, Daddy, Detective Armstrong typed, setting the hook.
Fung was silent for 2 solid minutes. No words, no flashing dots to show he was typing.
Finally, I guess, appeared in the dialogue box.
I'll text them to you, Armstrong slash Sugar said.
Just attach pics to message.
Nape, Armstrong replied, purposely misspelling a few words. Facebook already warned me about that. My mom could find out.
That's okay, Fung typed.
Callahan held her breath while the dots pulsed in the dialogue box. He was still making up his mind. Then his cell number appeared. Sitting at the desk beside Armstrong, Joe Rice entered the cellular number in his computer. He put an index finger to his head and pulled an imaginary trigger at Eddie Fung's stupidity.
Fung's dialogue box pulsed again.
Then, what's your contact info?
Armstrong typed the number to one of the office burner smartphones, so-called not because it was a prepaid, but because the disgusting photos that came across the devices rendered them unsuitable for anything but burning in a very hot fire once they'd been utilized as evidence for the prosecution. As soon as he entered the number, Armstrong typed POS, parent over shoulder, and logged out.
Joe Rice looked up from his computer and raised both fists high in the air.
He shoots, he scores, the crowd goes wild.
Talk to me, Joe, Callahan said.
Eddie Fung's phone is pinging a tower off Harry Hines Boulevard near the LBJ Expressway. Google Maps shows 2 strip clubs in that quadrant. One of them is closed until 6, but a place called Chicas Peligrosas opens at noon. It's not far from here.
Callahan stood again and grabbed her jacket, glaring across the squad room.
Why aren't y'all already in your cars?
Less than 10 minutes after Special Agent Kelsey Callahan slapped the flat of her hand on the top of her desk, 14 members of the North Texas Crimes Against Children Task Force followed her out the hangar door en route to Chicas Peligrosas. Considering the story Blanca Limón told her about Eddie Fung and his friends, Callahan thought she might just arrest everyone in the place. Even if they weren't involved with Fung, odds are they'd be sitting around watching a bunch of kids take their clothes off. It would do them good to cool their heels in Dallas County lockup until a judge cut them loose. They might beat the rap, but they wouldn't be able to beat the ride. Chapter 11. Less than 6 miles from the Dallas area CAC Task Force hangar, Jack Ryan Jr. slouched at his wobbly table and tried to figure out how he could unsee the sad scene unfolding amid the pulsing lights and throbbing music on the raised stage less than 10 feet away. He ordered a second bottle of Corona from a sullen Hispanic waitress. Unlike the girls on the stage, who wore nothing but tiny G-strings and sweaty layers of body glitter, the waitress got to wear a tube top. Unfortunately, it was so small it wouldn't have covered a roll of breath mints, let alone her full figure. Not that any strip club was an upstanding establishment, but there were strip clubs and there were strip clubs. These girls looked awfully young, and it made Jack feel dirty to be within 100 feet of them. He did his best impersonation of a happy-go-lucky frat boy, but a sticky film of unknown residue on the table's surface made him wish he'd worn long sleeves. The slightly sour smell of the place melded with the pulsing bass note from the speakers behind the stage, like some kind of enhanced interrogation measure, making it difficult to think. Ryan faced the dancers, but scanned the rest of the club with his peripheral vision, a respite from focusing on the poor girls on stage doing their level best to look sexy. He knew Chavez was doing the same, taking the left half of the club, including a couple tables of triad types and Fee-Fi-Fo-Fum, who remained by the front door. Jack looked predominantly at the area to his right. The strobe lights of the stage left the area extra dark, but he could just make out the curtained booths in the shadows along the back wall, where the special dance arrangements were taken care of. At the far end of the stage, Eddie Fung sat next to an equally sleazy-looking Tres Equis guy and tapped away on his iPad in between slugs of Red Bull. Fung was the polar opposite of the giant at the front door. His skin was pasty and pale, appearing to glow pulsing strobes. As with many of the people Ryan had followed over the years, there was nothing formidable about the man at all. In fact, calling him Wormy was a disservice to actual worms. In addition to working on the iPad, Fung scribbled notes in a spiral notebook on the table in front of him. Ryan didn't know exactly what this guy was up to, but he knew he wanted to get a look at that spiral notebook, as well as the iPad. Ryan nursed his beer, casting enough looks at the dark-eyed dancing girls so as not to appear out of place. He leaned sideways toward Chavez and spoke under his breath, hoping the mic on his neck loop would pick up his whisper and broadcast it to the rest of the team. "Our friend has a tablet computer I'd like to get my hands on." "Due time," Clark said. "Does it seem like he's being protected? Guarded by the cartel or triad?" Ryan fought the urge to shake his head at the question coming from his earpiece. "No," he said, still gawking at the stage and tilting his head as if speaking to Chavez. "There's a Hispanic guy at his table chatting him up, but everyone appears to be guarding the girls." "He's right," Chavez mumbled. "I'd lay odds that there's enough firepower in here to hold off a small army." "Good enough," Clark said. "Keep eyes on for another half hour. Sing out if it looks like you're starting to get stale." Adara's voice came across the radio, calm but direct. "That small army you mentioned," she said. "I've got 8 plainclothes officers coming your way from a half a block south. I'm betting they're feds, and not trained counter-intel types either. They're too overt covert." Jack nodded to himself, as if in time with the bass beat from the speakers. He knew exactly what Adara meant. Men and women who'd spent long careers carrying large and heavy firearms on their belts often tended to walk holding their arms slightly away from their bodies, even when they transitioned to a smaller, more concealable weapon for different duty. It took practice and concentration to overcome the effect of being a beat cop or even a suit-wearing detective. Simply wearing plain clothes did not make one covert. Dom broke squelch on the radio. 6 more of the same moving in from the north. There's a redhead leading the pack. She's Bureau, no doubt about it. I saw her belt badge when she got out of her car. I'm guessing this is some kind of task force. Clark's voice was tight, agitated. Ding, Ryan, haul ass out the back. I don't want you caught up in some whorehouse raid.
Copy that, Chavez said,
nodding toward the dark hallway at the rear of the building.
You lead the way, Mono, he said to Ryan. I'll be right behind you.
Jack was already on his feet, slouching between the row of tables and the stage toward the back door, as if he was looking for the restroom. He wasn't the sort to run from a fight, but his getting caught in a place like this would cost his father a great deal of political capital. Not to mention the fact that the resulting media attention would severely damage Jack's ability to continue working in a covert capacity. Even so, he turned to Chavez as they reached the end of the stage, stopping in his tracks. What about Fee-Fi-Fo-Fum? Chavez groaned, having already reached the same conclusion. He's gonna hurt somebody. The two men had worked together long enough that they generally knew what the other was thinking in any tactical situation. Neither wanted to leave approaching law enforcement to stumble into the strip club blind and come face to face with the armed behemoth. The task force agents would eventually gain the upper hand, but one of them was bound to get injured, and possibly even killed in the process. Ryan and Chavez each took a $20 bill from their pockets and stepped up to the stage. The two tired-looking girls turned, lowering their gyrating bodies to allow the men to stuff the money into their G-strings. The girl nearest Jack looked even younger up close. She had to be in her teens, probably the reason the cops were here. Throwing a quick look over his shoulder to make sure the giant by the door was watching, Jack gave an exuberant catcalling whistle, then put both hands flat on the stage as if to climb up and dance with the girl. Though not unheard of behavior in a titty bar, it was exactly what Fee-Fi-Fo-Fum had warned them not to do. They had not paid for the privilege. The giant sprang from his stool by the door with surprising dexterity.
"Pendejo!"
he roared above the throbbing music, lumbering toward Ryan. His bullish neck was arched and his head down, as if he intended to bowl Ryan over. Extremely big men may have doled out countless beatdowns, but they rarely had much real experience with anyone fighting back. Unfortunately for the bouncer, both Chavez and Ryan had plenty. Ryan yanked a wad of assorted bills from his pocket and pitched them onto the stage, hoping the investment would keep the girls busy doing something besides kicking him in the head. Chavez stepped deftly aside as the giant chugged by, giving him a stout two-handed shove from behind and causing him to go faster than his legs could carry him. Jack caught the man mid-stumble, grabbing him by the shaggy hair with both hands and directing his forehead toward the lip of the stage. Inertia and gravity did the rest. The resulting collision of bone against wood cracked like a rifle shot. Fee-Fi-Fo-Fum piled up on the filthy carpet at the base of the stage, moaning, both hands on his gashed forehead, trying to stanch the flow of blood. Chavez gave Ryan's arm a tug. "Haul ass," he said, without looking back. The nearest cartel guys sat at their table and blinked. It was inconceivable that anyone could knock out the big bouncer. Everything had happened so fast, it took them a moment to process what this white kid with the frosted hair and dark beard had done. Ryan turned to run, but came face to face with Eddie Fung, who was now on his feet, clutching his tablet computer in crossed arms. A commotion at the front drew the Taiwanese man's attention toward the door. Ryan took that moment to dip into his pocket and then reach under the edge of Fung's table. A strong adhesive held the GSM slap mic in place, leaving Ryan free to run down the hallway and out the back door, joining Chavez in the alley at the same moment law enforcement poured in the front door. 14 members of the Crimes Against Children Task Force button-hooked through the double doors 2 at a time, moving quickly as they came in to make room for the person behind them. They hadn't knocked or announced, so they'd seen no reason to cover the back door. With their sidearms drawn, they divided areas of responsibility as they scanned for danger. Chica's was a cartel joint, so it was a given that there would be guns inside. Joe Rice, The Waxahachie detective had suggested they call Dallas PD SWAT. Callahan had demurred, though she knew it was probably the smarter call. She wanted to take Eddie Fung herself, and right damn now, too, before he had a chance to contact even one more child online. She wasn't about to screw around waiting for a bunch of SWAT guys to convene and scratch their asses while they drew up a plan. With her FBI badge hanging from a chain on her neck, Kelsey Callahan pointed her pistol at the Sun Yi On triad turd nearest her and gave a shrill whistle to get everyone's attention. On cue, Special Agent Olsen cut the music and turned on what lights there were, which still didn't brighten things up much. A dead quiet fell over the club. The triad and cartel pukes just blinked, sizing up the task force like dogs consider a piece of meat. They were starting to get twitchy. "Eddie Fung," Callahan shouted, staring down a skinny Chinese gangbanger beside the stage. She lowered her voice slightly in an effort to defuse the situation. "I only want Eddie Fung." The triad guy's shoulders relaxed a notch. He tipped his head sideways toward a man with a faux hawk holding a computer tablet and a can of Red Bull. The bleeding gigantor lay at his feet. Two CAC task force officers moved in on Fung. One took the tablet while the other spun him none too gently and put on the cuffs. Callahan continued to scan the shabby club. "Nice and calm," she said, her voice steady and remarkably controlled considering how fast her heart was beating. She had to concentrate to focus on the threats and not the poor kids standing topless on stage. "Hands," she said. "Manos! Let's see hands!" 90 seconds later, 17 fuming members of Sun Yi On and Tres Equis sat on the floor in front of the stage, hands flex-cuffed behind their backs. The big guy slouched at the end of the line, blood still oozing from a nasty cut above his brow. One of the agents stood guard over 19 confiscated handguns, now cleared and stacked along with knives and assorted other weapons, from chains to bicycle locks. Callahan sat Eddie Fung back down at his table while two female CAC officers got the dancers some clothes and took them outside to interview in the cars, away from the accusing eyes of their pimps. Two agents secured the front and rear doors while the rest either pulled guard duty or stood in front of the guys lined up at the base of the stage, running them through Dallas PD dispatch for wants and warrants. Callahan tapped Fung's tablet, handing it off to Olsen. "Let's get this bagged before somebody wipes it." Olsen reached in his jacket and pulled out a black nylon sleeve, into which he slid Eddie Fung's computer. Often called a Faraday bag, the forensic evidence sleeve shielded the device from sending or receiving signals that might shut it down, remotely wipe the information, or inform a third party that it had been compromised. FBI techs would be able to take a better look once they got the device back to a shielded room. Fung slumped at the table, hands behind his back, his dark eyes casting around the place like a cornered animal. He glanced at the RF shielding bag and then up at Olsen. "There's no need for that. Hell, it's barely even encrypted." He leaned forward, chest against the table, as if to confide in Olsen. "We need to go somewhere else to talk." "And we will," Callahan said. Fung looked over his shoulder at the line of triad and cartel members. Every one of them was now staring daggers at the man. "Seriously," Fung said, "we should go." Ordinarily, Callahan would have agreed. But now the bad blood that had suddenly sprung up between Fung and the rest of the men made her think a few more minutes might rattle the guy's cage in a productive way. Her team had the inside of the club secured, and marked DPD cruisers were already rolling up to the front and rear doors. She didn't have to worry about the outer perimeter. Sticking around was safe enough, and even if it didn't turn out to be incredibly productive, it did Callahan's heart good to see this little prick squirm. "You have the wrong man," Fung whispered in accented English. "I'm one of the good guys." "You seriously need to shut up," Callahan snapped. Fung was the type who would talk, but she wanted to get the tap flowing good and strong of his own accord before she read him his Miranda warning. Often, the best way to do that with people like him was to tell them to be quiet. An Asian man with a buzz cut and full-sleeve tattoos craned his neck from his position at the base of the stage. He began to shout maniacally in Chinese, eyes wild, spittle flying from his drawn lips. Feng went pale, shrinking sideways in his chair to put even a few more inches between himself and the screaming triad soldier. A task force officer gave the tattooed man a shove with the toe of his boot. Instead of going quiet, the man rolled on his side, scrambling to his feet. He continued to scream in Chinese as he rushed toward Feng. Arms behind his back, the screaming triad puke fell flat on his face when Armstrong simply stomped on his foot. Feng suddenly stood, nearly knocking over the table, but Callahan shoved him back down. He seemed awfully frail, and it wasn't very difficult. She nodded to Armstrong and then the screaming triad guy. "Get him out of here, Germaine." She looked at the rest of her team. "Tase the next shitbag that so much as twitches without my permission." Olsen held up the bagged computer, unfazed by the commotion. "Is this going to be more of the same stuff?" Feng's face fell. "Same stuff as what?" Olsen shrugged, leaning back to rub his eyes. "Record of payment, maybe? Most of it is in code. Coronet gets mentioned a half a dozen times or so."
"Shh," Feng said, nearly apoplectic now. "Don't discuss that in here."
Callahan looked over Olsen's shoulder. They would need to get back to the office to concentrate on the data. But this was big stuff. She already knew the triads were running underage girls, but if they'd linked up with an offshoot of the Sinaloa cartel, that took this ballgame into a whole new league. The information on this guy's iPad could nail down a major human trafficking ring.
"I'm begging you," Feng whined. "Just get me out of here."
"You're in an awfully big hurry to go to jail," Callahan said. "Having sex with a minor is a pretty big deal here in Texas, Ed. Even the guys on the inside don't take kindly to child rapists."
"What are you talking about?"
Callahan decided to play a portion of her hand. "We have a thumb drive that came from you." Feng's face went slack.
"How?"
"We'll get to that," she said.
"Can we get to it somewhere else? Officer..."
"Special agent," she corrected. "Callahan, FBI.
"Okay. Special Agent Callahan,"
Feng said, chewing on his trembling bottom lip. He'd become wooden, his words barely audible.
"There's more going on than you realize. Take me somewhere safe. I promise I'll tell you everything I know."
Ryan and Chavez moved their rented Dodge to a cracked asphalt parking lot behind an abandoned warehouse 3 blocks from Chicas Peligrosas. John Clark and the others had scattered to various locations in the area. The GSM mic broadcast on a cell signal, so there was no need for them to congregate any closer and risk being caught by responding officers. Chavez gave Ryan a nod during a lull in the conversation.
"I guess this Feng character is a big deal after all. Sorry I doubted you, Jack."
Ryan raised an eyebrow, grinning.
"Wait," he said. "You doubted me?"
Feng started talking again. It sounded like he was about to break down in tears.
"Seriously," he said, "you have to promise to keep me safe."
"I can do that," Agent Callahan said. "But why should I?" Chavez grimaced and mouthed,
"Heartless. I like her."
Feng insisted he be taken somewhere else before he would talk. Callahan continued to play hard-ass, reminding him of the trouble he was in for sanctioning child prostitution. Clark's voice came over the radio, sounding strained and fatigued.
"Dom," he said, "I assume you have your FBI credentials?"
"I don't leave home without 'em, boss," Caruso said.
Officially on special, unspecified duty away from his assigned field office, Dominic Caruso maintained his commission as a special agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. This often made him the only member of the campus who could legally carry a weapon in all 50 states and U.S. territories. Not that any of them let a little thing like that stop them from packing. Many of the things they did overseas were, in point of fact, against the law. It was the way of counterintelligence work. The fact that one's government sanctioned an action in no way made that action legal in another country, no matter how moral or right it might be. Clark continued. The human trafficking is bad enough, but there's more going on here than that. Eddie Fung is a piece of shit, but he knows something, as evidenced by Jack's earlier discovery about the Beijing subway bombing. We need to find out what that something is. Dom, I'll get Jerry to pull a few strings with the Bureau so you can insinuate yourself into Special Agent Callahan's investigation. Stick with her and find out what she knows. The rest of us will back off a bit and do more research into the unholy union between the Sun Yeon Triad and the Tres Equis men.
Copy that, Caruso said. I'll follow at a discreet distance when they come out, and then introduce myself to Special Agent Callahan in an hour or so.
That should give me enough time, Clark said. I'll let you know. Over the radio, Fung's voice changed from whining to demanding.
If you don't get me out of here, I'm going to have to ask for a lawyer.
You do that, Callahan said. We'll see then what kind of protection you get.
Look, Fung was sobbing again. I was bluffing about a lawyer. Just put me in solitary. These animals would kill me 5 minutes after I go into general population. I swear, I'll give you everything I've got.
The voice of a male agent came across now. Including whatever code you're using?
Yes.
Sniff, sniff. And what all the numbers mean in your data?
Yes.
And who they correspond to?
If I know.
How about Coronet? The male voice asked. Who or what is that?
What is wrong with you people?
Fung spoke so quietly now that the GSM mic barely picked up his words.
I said I'd tell you, but you have to get me out of here.
So tell, Callahan said. Show some good faith.
Okay,
Fung whispered.
This guy, Coronet, I think he's some kind of spy.
The man with La Santa Muerte tattooed on his neck sat down the street from Chicas Peligrosas in his 1994 S10 pickup. He ground his teeth, discolored from years of smoking hand-rolled cigarettes. The man's name was Javier Goya, but everyone called him Moco. At 29, he'd spent more than a third of his life behind bars, and he'd decided after he got out the last time, he wasn't going back. His leg bounced on the floorboard, rocking the little truck and drawing a look from Gusano, the man who sat beside him.
You got the need for weed, Gusano said.
Shut up, cabron, Moco said, knowing his partner was right. Gusano had once eaten a worm on a bet, earning his name, and Moco thought him just about as smart as one of the slimy creatures. Moco pounded his fist against the steering wheel, causing dust to rain down from the headliner of the S10 pickup. He had to be the luckiest son of a bitch in the world. The Tat, a sculled female figure with scythe and beckoning bony fingers, was a prison job he'd gotten while incarcerated in Huntsville's Eastern Unit. The guy running the block had suggested the design, as long as Moco was ready for what went along with it, and sent him to another guy who worked in the kitchen. This other guy was a crazy old Mexican artist from Reynosa who used ink from the soot of burned baby oil, mixed with pages from the Bible. That ink must have been some potent shit, because La Santa Muerte had protected Moco well over the years. If you didn't count the nickel he did in Darrington for selling a tiny bit of black tar heroin to an undercover cop in Bridgeport, Texas. The state was serious about punishing drug crimes. But nobody shanked him while he was inside, and that was saying something in a place as bloody as Darrington. La Santa Muerte was sure as hell looking out for him today. At first he'd been pissed that his truck had broken down, but if the alternator had not gone out, he and Gusano would have been inside Chicas Peligrosas when the feds showed up, which meant they would have tried to put him back inside, which in turn meant he would have shot it out and very likely ended up dead. But that hadn't happened, thanks to La Santa Muerte. Now he watched as his friends were frog-marched one by one out the front door of the strip club, hands cuffed behind their backs and stuffed into waiting cop cars. A tall Hispanic and a pissed-looking redhead, both wearing FBI raid jackets, came out last, flanking that asshole Eddie Fung. Moco had never trusted that guy. He was always snooping around, paying good money for girls who weren't worth a dime bag, and asking questions about things that were none of his business. One way or another, he was behind this. Moko used his cell phone to snap photos of as many of the cops as he could,